All right, this is AP and Spence. We're two lawyers talking college sports and sports law in general. It is a cloudy, it started out nice today.
It did, but
now a little cloudy. Could get a little chilly out there tonight, but it's okay.
I heard we're gonna have a good weekend, though. I hope so.
Beautiful weather we're supposed to have. It'd be nice. I'm hoping to get out on a bike ride.
Yeah,
you know, I did a triathlon last weekend.
The Beaver Freezer.
Yeah, it went well, but it was cold. It was pouring down rain during my bike ride, which is not fun to ride in.
Well, I've never done a triathlon. That's amazing. Congratulations, even completing it. I heard you had a goal in mind of a time.
Yeah, I didn't quite meet the goal, but I still completed it, and I was happy with my time.
But you nearly met your goal.
I nearly met my goal by 20 seconds. I was off by 20 seconds. My goal was to go over an hour, 30 minutes, and I did an hour, 30 minutes, and 20 seconds.
Okay.
And what killed me was the first transition between the swim and the bike. It took me forever to get on the bike, and I need to work on that. But
it's like footwork?
No, like changing, like putting on warmer biking clothes so I could get on the bike and I could run, I could go on the bike, you know, and I'm not just going in my swim trunks, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, so we got things to work on, but you were right there.
I'll get it next time.
Good.
Okay. How about you? Anything new?
Well, this weekend, my daughter has soccer. She starts soccer, so I'm hoping that the weather is good. So she does soccer and now gymnastics. She got invited to do a higher up level of gymnastics. She's 4 years old, by the way. So 2 days of gymnastics, a day of soccer.
But she's got it in her jeans.
Yeah,
you know.
I know.
For those who don't know, AP is quite the athlete.
I did play a couple of sports in my day, but I just had no height at all. And I chose sports that liked height, like basketball. And so that was my downfall. So she's we're gonna have a good weekend. But we've been tracking, like we track the weather here, Spence.
That's right.
We've been tracking the Oregon Ducks lawsuit in the NCAA, Willie Taggart. This is kind of on a lot of people's minds, especially here in the Northwest, where we're tracking the weather. We're tracking the Ducks as well.
Yeah, so this week they did that in this lawsuit, a couple things were done. The first thing that they did, which is the first thing that you typically do when you're starting a trial, is something called voir dire, okay?
Voir dire.
Now, voir dire.
I love these Latin phrases. Right? Is it Latin or
it's
something?
Latin,
I don't know. What does it mean?
I don't know what actually voir dire means.
I'd like to know.
I don't know. We could look it up, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But so voir dire is a phrase. Oh, do you want to leave that up there?
Oh, my bad. I got it right there.
So voir dire is a Latin phrase. Let's see what it means. Okay, it means
a preliminary examination of a witness or a juror by a judge or counsel.
I know, but that's not the exact voir dire interrogation. Okay, well.
Yeah, so that, yeah.
I don't know.
So that's what it means.
I don't know what it means. So basically what it means is
to speak the truth.
To speak the truth.
Oh, voir dire, to speak the truth.
To speak the truth.
There okay.
All right, so basically what this is an opportunity for attorneys to select a jury. Okay, and what you do as you're going through voir dire is you're given an opportunity to ask the jurors certain questions. Questions like, do you know any of the parties that are named in the lawsuit? And if they do, you know, they may say, oh yeah, I know Willie Taggart. He and I went to law school, you know, we played football together at Florida State or whatever. And
so you're looking kind of for potential biases?
Biases, like how, you know, you can ask questions like, how would you feel about, you know, if someone is violating a rule? Or, you know, how would you feel if someone has a responsibility to do certain things or act a certain way? You can ask real questions, and it's an opportunity for attorneys to introduce themselves to the jury pool, because you'll have a large jury pool of a number of different jurors, and you ultimately have to settle on 12, usually with a few alternates. And so you want to pick the best 12, and each side gets to pick and gets to exclude certain people and kick certain people off. It's a fascinating process. And if you ever get a chance to sit down and watch attorneys who are really good at it, the ones who are really good at it come and sit down and just have a conversation with the jury. And then they go back and they talk about it and they say, we want 1, 4, and 7 off. And they bring number 27, 28, and 30 back on. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, and they're so good at it so quick because they can just read people really quickly. I mean, we're talking high stakes here, right? This is a $125 million lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money. And they want to have a jury that's going to be able to, you know, for both sides, because both sides gets to, you know, exclude people and include people. So it's kind of a fun process. So after Voidir, then the next thing that's happened in this lawsuit is opening statements. Okay. Now, AP, when you're given an opening statement, what are you trying to get across to the decision maker, whether that's a jury or a judge?
Well, yeah. So if I'm given an open statement, there's always a strategy that I have in mind. I want them to see a big roadmap, large picture roadmap of the issues I want them to focus on. And I'm going to frame it in the way I want to frame it. You know, for example, hey, judge, I want you to think about A, B, and C. You're going to hear them say this. You're going to hear them say that. And I'm framing things for the judge to pay attention to. I also might anticipate some of the other side's arguments in my opening. And depending on what I think that how they're going to come across in their opening, because they might have a chance to do it, I want to combat that. I used to do that in law school, too, when I was in moot court. If you did moot court, I think, as well.
I did do moot court.
And I used to anticipate what the other side was going to say as an argument, and I would get in front of it, and then I would give a rebuttal to it in my opening. You might hear the other side say this, Your Honor, but here's the deal. You might hear that, Your Honor, but here's the deal. And so when they go, if they've already prepared their opening argument, I've already rebutted it, kind of. Right. So it's going to maybe sound not as impactful. That's fine. So there's a strategy to that. But overall, it's a short roadmap of what I want the judge to think about. How do you do it?
Yeah, same. Same. You know, the old argument, you don't want to give your best arguments up front, right?
No.
Yeah. So yeah, and I like the term you used, and I agree with it 100%. It's a roadmap.
Yeah.
It's a roadmap of what you want the decision maker, whether that's a jury or a judge, that what you want them to pay attention to.
Yeah.
So you highlight certain things, but you also don't allow, you know, you don't want to share certain arguments that are like your best arguments in these opening statements.
Right.
Because you want to let that evidence come out.
Right.
So it's a term of art. Now, what's interesting is that, you know, we don't have the length of the defense opening statements. We know that the plaintiff's opening statement was about 93 minutes, which is an hour and a half.
And that is an unbelievable. My opening statement sometimes in workers' comp cases might be, I mean, it varies, of course, but maybe a couple of minutes, three, four minutes, five minutes.
Short to the point, right? And I think
hour and a half.
But opening arguments in a highly complex claim can last a while. You know, and
are you typing those up, do you think?
Some
are you
do.
Reading it?
Right, some do. But I think the better lawyers know the facts.
Yeah.
Inside and out, so that they can get up.
They're not going to get tripped up.
And they're not going to get tripped up. So a lot of times, both AP and I argue cases at the Oregon Court of Appeals and at the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And when you're going into one of those arguments, you've got to, and you're doing your opening statement, you've got to know those facts backwards and forwards so that no matter what happens, you can just talk off the top of your head.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And you're trying to memorize things.
If you come across memorizing things, it comes across as like kind of disingenuous a little bit because you're reading off of a script. But if you're just talking to the judges or to a judge or a jury and you're just having a conversation, but a 93 minute opening argument, I'm sure he wrote some things down.
At least bullet points.
But he probably knows the facts of this case backwards and forwards. So some of the key issues that they address, and this is what I wanted to kind of chat with you about. We're going to get into, there was some evidentiary stuff that was kind of interesting, but there was a couple of things that they brought up in their opening arguments, which were things that we didn't talk about last week. So the first thing was that one of the plaintiff's main arguments against the NCAA is that the NCAA has an acclimatization period for athletes.
Yep.
So that when they get to school, that they can't just get to school and jump right into hard, hard workouts. Mm-hmm. But that does not apply, they argue, to winter strength and conditioning workouts. So part of their argument, it appears, is that against the NCAA, is that the NCAA says, hey, you have this acclimatization period in the fall, right, or for spring practice or whatever, but you don't apply that same thing to winter strength and conditioning workouts.
I can blow that up right now.
Okay, let's hear it.
You want to hear it?
Yeah.
So, okay, I've heard this argument before, right? And so, man, I wish I was part of this. So the acclimatization period is a period for football where you phase in as you start doing on-field activities. Practice number one is basically in helmets, and you're basically in helmets and t-shirts. No pads, no spiders. That's the first two practices have to be that way. The next two practices, so practices 3 and 4, are shoulder pads and helmets. So you can do a little bit more. You get some shoulder pads on, you get some helmets. Practice number 5, you can go full pads, you go full force. Why? It's because you're live hitting people, you're live running around on the field, that sort of thing. But it doesn't apply to weightlifting. The spring, when January starts, remember we talked about that with the Kara, it's lifting weights, it's running. You aren't hitting anybody. You're not, so the NCAA is not worried about getting you up to speed to get in shape and run around. They're worried about you're going to start hitting people. We don't want coaches hitting people live on practice number 1. They want to wait till practice 5. So they force you not to wear certain gear. We would do this all the time, where somebody would come in practice 1, they're in t-shirt and helmets, practice 2, t-shirt and helmets, practice 3 and 4, shoulder pads, helmets, practice 5, full pads, they're going hard. It doesn't make sense in spring because the spring ball doesn't start for about 6 weeks after doing weights. And so what you'd be having an acclimation period from lifting weights, right? That's what they're saying. So right. You'd be like, oh, I'm not going to get on that treadmill because the NCAA says I have an acclimation period, so I'm going to just walk at 3 miles an hour today. Right, but they don't have that for any sport, and they never have, and they're saying, well, they should. I don't know about that, but anyways, that's how it works.
Interesting. So yeah, that was one thing that I saw in their opening arguments because the lawyers for Brenner are alleging a $100 million punitive lawsuit against the NCAA, and it appears that one of their main arguments is this acclimatization period. Mm-hmm. That is not required for weights and conditioning and winter workouts. So, anyways, I just thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah. So that's some interesting stuff. Some of the other arguments that were made were, you know, kind of turning the responsibility back on the plaintiff, right? Uh-huh. So the defense is kind of saying, hey, listen, the plaintiff has some responsibility in this too. And that's a term of art that's sometimes used, that's sometimes called comparative negligence, right? So comparative negligence, how would you explain that?
Yeah, I would say comparative negligence is like the idea that you're also at fault. So for example, let's say there's a banana peel. This is a dumb example, but I want to dumb it down as simple as possible for anybody to understand, right? You got a banana peel that's sitting there in a store. You see the banana peel, yet you keep on walking. Walk at it, step on it, slip, and land on your butt and get hurt.
Yeah.
People are going to say, maybe that's not a great example, but the idea is, oh, well, gosh, you have some comparative fault, meaning you're at fault too a little bit. The store's at fault for having the banana there, but you could have avoided it. You could have walked around it. You're at fault too. And that's a terrible example, but the idea is you're at fault too. Same with a car accident where you have two moving cars. What if you have two cars next to each other and they both change lanes at the same time? Well, they both made errors. They didn't see the person that was next to them, but they're both at fault. This isn't one person or the other. Maybe it's 60-40, 70-30, 80-20, but compared to faulty idea, you have some fault too. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. That's a great explanation. And yeah, that's an argument that a lot of times will come up in cases where you know there's some contested liability or you know who's at fault. You know, they want it because what'll happen is If a jury awards let's say the jury awards $1 million in this case, the jury says, yep, we believe Brenner is absolutely injured, yep, but we find that Brenner was 25% at fault, that he should have stopped the workouts or he should have modified the workouts or whatever his comparative fault is would be. What would happen is that then the judge would lessen the award by 25%. So if it was $1 million lawsuit, that would be lessened by $250,000. And then the judgment against, you know, the NCAA or again, Willie Taggart or whoever would be $750,000. So that, which is kind of an interesting, you know, aspect of the law.
Yeah. Do you know in Oregon, is it one of those where if you're more than half or you're half at fault, you can't collect anything? Or is it pure, meaning like, if you're 99% at fault, you can still get 1%?
I don't know. I don't know that the answer to that question. That's something I'll have to look up. But I'm pretty sure you've got to get more than 50%
yeah.
to be found to get an award. So I think that if they went 50-50, or if they went 49% NCAA Oregon, Willie Taggart, that they would be out.
They're out. Yeah.
So anyways, we'll have to figure. I'll do some research.
We'll get back on our you have to check our website, our page for that.
That's right. So a couple of things that Willie Taggart's lawyer argued, which I thought was interesting. So if you recall last week, we talked about how Willie Taggart was saying that, or that their attorney, the plaintiff's lawyer, Brenner's lawyer, was saying, we're going to find the snakes in the grass and cuts their heads off. That Taggart's lawyer was saying that applied to discipline and accountability, not threats related to the workouts that would follow 2 days later, and that they had no intent to injure. Okay, so because I think if the argument is negligence, right? If the argument is negligence and there wasn't an attempt to injure, then could you even have the mental state to meet that level of intent to injure? And we'll just have to see what a jury decides. But that's kind of another interesting argument.
Yeah, intent to injure. Intent is hard to prove, right? I mean, like, how can you prove someone's intent? Like, if he just gets on the stand and says, I didn't intend that, what are some ways that you as an attorney can help prove intent?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's very hard, right? It's very hard. So you've got to, the best way is to find some type of smoking gun or some type of golden thing where you've got a memo or a statement or a letter or something that confirms the mental state of the person at the time of the action, right?
Yeah.
Some statement saying from Taggart to another witness who's going to come in and say, hey, Willie Taggart told me that he was going to push these kids and he was going to hurt them and punish them because if they had a 4-8 record last year.
Yep.
Right? That's the kind of thing that could go to the intent that they wanted to hurt somebody.
Yeah.
So that's the best way, because typically when you're asking witnesses on the stand or witnesses in a courtroom or in a deposition to get into their own mental state, most of the time, especially in these high-stake lawsuits, you're dealing with people who are well-coached, well-prepared. And so if you ask them that type of a question, they're going to say, of course I didn't intend to injure anybody.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
So that's why you need some type of a mental state, some type of evidence, some type of statement outside the courtroom that can be used. Now, a lot of times that will draw an objection if it's an out-of-court statement. That's hearsay. A lot of times people hear the word hearsay and they think they know what that means. Hearsay is an out-of-court statement that is being used to prove the truth of something in court.
So, for example, could I try to give you an example? Let's say, what if I said, I'm on the stand and I said, well, Bill said, I'm talking about yesterday when I was out on the street, he said XYZ.
Yeah.
And we're trying to prove that's true.
Yeah, right. So that would be hearsay. But there are some exceptions to hearsay. And one of the exceptions that you could use to prove mental state is what's called a statement that's against interest, against the person's interest. So if Willie Taggart is saying, I never told anybody that we were going to injure these kids, and you have some witness come up on the stand and say, hey, he told me his goal was to injure people, that would draw an objection from from Willie Taggart's attorney.
The objection would be
hearsay, out of court statement being used to prove something. But then the plaintiff's lawyer in that circumstance would say, this is an out of court statement that is being used, or this is an admission against that individual. So it's an admission against that individual, and that would be allowed as an admission.
Because the person's saying it, and it's against their own interest, so it's more than likely true.
Right, exactly. There are a number of evidentiary rules, and we're not going to get into all of them today. But that was one of them. That's one of them that I thought we could talk about here a little bit. Now, the last thing I wanted to talk about was this. There was a piece of evidence that was initially excluded from the court, okay, and what happened was, in a few years ago, there was a University of Iowa football player who was involved in strenuous workouts, developed the same kidney failure diagnosis, And receive. And
I would like you to say, what is this specific diagnosis that we keep seeing in all the documents? It's spelled. I'll spell it for you, Spence.
Yeah.
RHABDOMYOLYSIS.
That's very easy. I'll pronounce it right now.
Rhabdomyolysis.
There you go.
Rhabdomyolysis.
Rhabdomyolysis.
Yeah, I changed my voice. That's pretty good.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, you got a little high pitch there.
A little high pitch, yeah. But
rhabdomyolysis.
There you go.
That's fantastic. That's how you pronounce that. And so essentially, this is some sort of a kidney disease.
It's a kidney disease
that's
progressive from being pushed so strenuously that it starts to shut down your kidneys. And it can happen over time. Now, what happened was that this University of Iowa player, he developed
rhabdomyolysis
and got a $15,000 settlement from the University of Iowa related to this case, which was, it went all the way through court, and there was a $15,000 award. Okay,
so why is that being mentioned in this case?
Right, great question. So, I think that the NCAA and the University of Oregon, if I'm defending them, I want to bring that up because I want to get the jury thinking. This really isn't that big of a damage type claim.
Yeah. So this guy settled for $15,000. This is small potatoes. This is the same thing.
That's right.
Because if you get award something, award $15,000.
One of their big arguments in this case is against Brenner, who's the plaintiff, is that he's not really that injured. Mm-hmm. He ended up playing all 4 years, right? And then he didn't make it in the NFL. And so he's trying to say, hey, this is because I've got this kidney failure, and this is all caused by these workouts.
Right. But it's like, but you finished your career there.
Yeah.
Right. How hurt were you? Right.
That's so, what they're saying. So they're arguing he's totally, anyway, so they're saying, okay, yeah, there were some mistakes made. Yeah, we pushed him too hard. That's true. But he didn't get that badly injured. And to the extent that he's got this permanent injury, let me show you what this is worth in another venue. Right.
In my first thought, if I'm doing the Spence, and I know some of the rules on evidence, I thought you couldn't talk about settlements at a trial.
You're exactly right. So typically, settlements are and settlement negotiations are not allowed, even in other cases, in court. And the reason why is because it's a public policy reason. So essentially, the court wants parties to settle, right? If there has not been a settlement, that means that something has broken down, right? And you're mucking up the court's time, and the court is super busy, and they want parties to settle. There's a huge push to settle, right?
Yeah, public policy, meaning like this benefits the public to do this. Because if you guys, you'd be kind of chilled. You wouldn't want to negotiate if you knew that if it failed, somebody could say right in court, yeah, well, Spencer Kelly was willing to settle for $20,000 exactly. Before he came in front of you. Now look what he's doing. He's won $100 million, right? And you don't want that.
Yeah.
But what if you do that? Is what happens? What's the consequence?
Well, the consequence is it could be a mistrial, right? And you might have to start all over. And if you've spent a lot of money bringing in these experts and you're talking about all of this stuff and you go through it and you've got to go, you'd have to start all over. And the whole case could get thrown out, right? It depends on how egregious the attorneys are being. So the NCAA in Oregon wanted to bring this evidence in about this $15,000 lawsuit. But then what happened in this case was just really interesting, and this is why I wanted to bring it up, was the judge initially said, nope, it's too prejudicial. We've got to leave that out. The jury would be swayed by that information.
Right. Yeah, they're going to think the case is worth $15,000. This has nothing to do with this case.
Exactly.
Get it out.
Exactly. And so the judge, in my opinion, correctly kept that out.
Right.
But then what happened was the plaintiff's lawyers then called one of their experts who brought that up on the stand. Right? And so if I'm Oregon and I'm in the NCAA and I'm Willie Taggart's attorney, I am applauding the plaintiff's lawyer because that's a mistake on the plaintiff's lawyer.
Yeah, because, yeah, you brought it in.
So then the judge reversed the prejudicial decision, and that information then, all of it, came in. So if you're doing one of these lawsuits and your attorney brings in something that the judge had previously said should not come in, And it was the motion to exclude that information was made by the plaintiff, right? Wasn't made by Oregon NCAA because they wanted it.
Yeah.
Judge agreed, left it out. But then the plaintiff, I don't know what he was thinking, brings that in through one of his experts. So therefore, that prejudicial order is thrown out the wayside.
That's interesting. Yeah. And so it comes in. So it sounds like the plaintiff's attorneys can talk about settlements.
No, I mean, yes, they could. Anybody can talk about it.
Right, but it came in over the objection of the other side.
Yeah, no, so right. No, so that's why this is really confusing.
Yeah, because that's weird,
the
right?
Plaintiff's lawyer.
I know what you're saying, but
the
plaintiff's
lawyer screwed up here. Essentially, that's what it comes down to.
They screwed up and allowed something that was reference and materials of witness they called.
They called, and so therefore, all of that information came in.
It comes in because it's relevant.
Because it's relevant. And they brought it up, even though they had objected to it previously.
Yeah, so it's almost like you're letting in another bucket. It's not let in because it's settlement communications. It's let in because it's relevant evidence that they brought in on the stand.
That's right.
And that becomes part of the record.
So that's basically what's going on. There have been a few other witnesses called. Marcus Mariota was supposed to testify. He was not able to, so they're going to do that next week. Marcus Mariota is probably the most famous Oregon alum?
He won a Heisman.
Maybe up there with Dan Fouts. And,
He's always going to be a legend there.
He was the first Oregon Duck to ever win a Heisman.
Yeah.
He is a football royalty here in Oregon.
Oh, yeah.
And so he's going to testify. You know, so they had another number of other people testify. So it'll be interesting to see who else comes and testifies, and we'll talk about this again probably not next week because we've got some going on next week, which is super exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
But we'll follow up here in a couple of weeks. So let's take a little break, and when we come back, let's talk about some NCAA rule changes real quick, and then get everybody set up for the weekend.
I love it. Let's do it.
All right, here we are. We are back. We had to take a quick break because in the law, sometimes you have people that just kind of show up in the middle of the day, even when you're taping a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. This is a live podcast that we're doing at work, right? I mean, like, you know, on a Friday afternoon when it's slower and stuff. But, yeah, things pop up. You know, we're not sitting around coffee. It's Saturday at 2 o'clock around the golf course. We're at our desk.
Maybe we should try that one.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, let's go. We've never hit the links together.
We should hit the links. I mean, we're going to be in Salishan coming up, right?
Go.
Salishan, Oregon.
That's the thing. So next week, we will not have an episode. We apologize in advance because both Aaron and I are going to be at a yearly, basically a two-day-long CLE, which is a continuing legal education class. And in fact, this year, something's kind of exciting is happening.
Yeah, yeah. We're both going to be presenting at it, which I mean, I've never presented. You haven't for a little while.
Yeah, it's been a couple years.
You know, and so we're both going to be presenting at the same one. So two guys, same firm. So welcome.
Different topics.
Totally different topics. Yeah. And we're not presenting together. You're presenting one day. I'm doing the next day. I got the, I think, 8 a.m. slot or 9 a.m. slot, whatever that early morning Saturday slot is. But you have a Friday one, and we're going to present some knowledge.
I actually am going to be on Saturday, too.
Oh, we're both on Saturday.
So you're at 8, I'm at 10. So there's a presentation in between our two presentations. And then, you know, so it's going to be really, really fun.
It'll be a lot of fun. Yeah. So Saturday is going to be a lot of fun. And I think both of us have similar styles of, we want to make it fun and lighthearted, not take ourselves too seriously. And because you have there's one or two attorneys out there that might do that, to be a little stiff, a little serious, right? And you think that they sound great, but is that exciting to listen to on a Saturday? I don't know.
Yeah, well, and we try to make things, let's make them fun.
Make them fun.
Let's go.
Yeah.
All right. So, again, we apologize. No show next week. But before we go today, we wanted to talk about, there have been a couple of rule changes that are going to take effect in 2022. The first thing is the targeting penalty. So, right now, if you get dinged for targeting in the first half, you're out the whole game.
Yep.
If you get dinged for targeting in the second half, you then have to miss the first half of the next game. So now they've changed the rules so that it sounds like the player can still be kicked out of the game. But that between that and the next game, the school can appeal the decision to the NCAA. National coordinating officials, and they'll review it and decide if it was targeting and if the player should be ejected for the first half of the next game. What do you think about that change?
I mean, I think it makes sense because you're carrying over a penalty into another game, so it's pretty harmful. Although, gosh, part of me would think that, like, you know, I guess there's no way to get your thing back. Let's say you had a bad call in the first half of targeting and it really wasn't. There's no way you can go back in time. I mean, the toothpaste is out of the tube. Here they're trying to say, well, let's just make sure this was the right call. because why are we going to punish this guy the next week if it was a crappy call? So right. I think it just makes sense. Targeting is really brutal. If you remember, USC had their punter ejected for targeting on the very first play of a game.
Right.
Which is, I don't think that's ever happened.
I can't think of that ever happening.
Yeah, so just, you know, targeting is kind of helmet-to-helmet contact. You're leading with your head. It's first safety. But it's starting to get where some of those calls are just bad calls. And why affect somebody going into the next game if it was a bad call? So I think this is a no-brainer. It makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so the other two rules that have changed. One is kind of a blocking issue, simplifying the rules surrounding blocking below the waist. Linemen and stationary backs blocking below the waist inside the tackle box and scrimmage plays will be permitted now. However, any such action outside the tackle box will be penalized. Fair?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. These seem like common sense rule changes.
Yeah. Last one is the faking injuries. Now, this is something that has been a little bit of a, you know, some schools, especially when you're playing a school that plays with tempo.
Yeah.
It seems like there will be times where there will be a player. I know USC has never done this, right?
Well, you know, yeah, it's funny that you brought this up. when the Oregon Ducks were at their height under Chip Kelly.
Yeah.
I was at the game. It was 2012, and it was USC, it was Oregon, it was Chip Kelly, and they were at their height. The Ducks were – so I'm talking to one of the officials. True story. I'm on the field. I'm getting ready for compliance. I talked to one of the officials, and I said, can you please at least not let them begin before you set the chains? Because they were moving so fast, the ref would run, place the ball down, they would hike it, and they don't even have the chain set yet. Right. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I saw it live. They were going so fast, people weren't lined up. It was goofy, Spence. And so the ref said, well, we're going to do the best we can. That was his answer. So we went out there, played this game. The game was, I think it was 62-56, the Ducks won.
Holy cow.
At the Coliseum. It was like, it was Lane Kiffin, and it was unbelievable fast-paced game. I've never seen anything like it. Well, you know, these kind of up-tempo things. Well, the idea was, right, when a team's rolling, run 4 yards, run, hike, you fake an injury. You go to the ground, my knee hurts, the game stops, right? Yeah. You know who else did this? Like Jason Kidd. Did you see that where he like faked somebody
hit me? He dropped some water.
It's been going on forever. You find a way to stop the game, stop the clock, get a longer timeout, whatever. But the problem is, what I don't like about it is how are you going to prove that, right? If somebody goes on the ground grabbing their knee, how are you going to say it's fake? I guess they would just look at tape after the fact.
That's exactly right. So the school can allege that the injuries are fake, and it can go before the same committee who's going to review these targeting penalties, national coordinating officials, and if they feel that these were faked injuries, that they can penalize, they can discipline the school. Now, what that means, who knows? But that they can do that. And they're saying that the injured person has to sit out at least one play, which I thought was already the rule.
Yeah, I think that is. I know if you lose your helmet, that's the rule for sure. If your helmet comes off, you have to sit out.
I know, but I'm pretty sure that if the coaches come out to get a kid and pull him off, they have to sit out at least one play.
Yeah, I think that's the rule. But if it's not, it should be, right? Yeah. But no, that makes sense. Yeah, you have to put things in. I like that. Like, in fact, what you could say is if somebody's injured, then they have to sit out a minute off the clock. There's different things you could do, but the problem is that you would put the players you don't really need to run out there and fake an injury. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's not such an issue now, but when the up-tempo stuff started, it can also disrupt a team, right? You get, first down, nice running thing. You're in a rhythm. Okay, let's fake an injury. We're on the field for 5 minutes. That slows everything down, gives our defense a breather that they can catch their breath. And then go, okay, we're ready for some defense now. You don't want that. That's not fair. You're stopping the game artificially. So they do need to address that.
Yeah. So those are the three rule changes that are going to take place next year. Be interesting to see how those take effect and if it changes anything. I don't know. I mean, I don't think the blocking really changes anything. I don't think the targeting may change something if it's an egregious call.
Yeah.
But a lot of times targeting is targeting. I mean, it's, you know, it's rare that it'll be like, you know,
like they were way off.
Way off. Right, you know. But it happens.
It just protects against that. But, you know, it's obviously a couple people complained about this stuff and they're trying to address it.
Yeah.
You know.
All right. So that's essentially, I feel like that's basically what I wanted to chat about today. The sun has come out.
Yeah.
Let's get going. Let's get home. Let's have a good weekend.
Yeah.
What do you got on plan this weekend?
Yeah. So tonight we have dinner at Grandma's house on Friday night down in Salem. Uh-huh. And then Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, my 4-year-old daughter starts soccer. She's a vicious, ruthless competitor, hates losing like you've never seen. I mean, tears on the ground. I mean, she is ruthless. And so she's pretty good, has a lot of fun with it. And then we might try a little fishing. She got a new fishing pole. And there's a little place in Salem that we can go by and have her toss a little thing in there. And then on the wife and I might go see a movie tomorrow night. And then on Sunday, it's going to be church. And then we're getting ready back to come back for a short week next week, Monday through Thursday, because we're heading to the beach Thursday night or Friday morning.
It's going to be awesome. Yeah, great. Well, we hope everybody has a great weekend this weekend. Enjoy some NFL or NBA playoffs, maybe?
Playoffs.
I mean, the Blazers aren't in it. I'm not really that interested, but I might watch a minute or two.
Yeah, I'll watch a couple minutes, but I do wish the Blazers were halfway competitive. I mean, it is brutal. Next year, they're going to turn it around.
Hopefully. All right, everybody, take care and be safe.